Welcome to The Frenzy.
I'm Melissa Carter.
And I'm Jen Hobby. The Frenzy's mission is to celebrate friendships over 40.
We believe that women can thrive through authentic relationships, self-discovery, and spiritual exploration.
Our decades-long friendship continues to grow because we are willing to go there and share our truths through life's highs and lows.
That's why The Frenzy is here, to hold space for women who are 40 and older, because at this age, your story matters more than ever.
Hey friends, before we dive into today's episode, Melissa and I wanted to let you know that it is definitely covering more adult material, so you probably don't want little ears listening along with you. While we think you are going to love this interview with sex therapist Dr. Holly Richmond, it also is going to cover some topics that you may find difficult. We are going to talk with her about recovering from sexual trauma, so if this is a challenge for you to hear, we just wanted to make you aware before we dive in. And Melissa and I believe that if you are struggling with something serious, it's always best to seek the individualized care of a medical professional. That said, we hope you enjoy this episode and get as much out of it as we did. Dr. Holly Richmond, welcome to The Frenzy.
Thank you so much, Jen. I'm really excited to be here.
Dr. Richmond is a licensed marriage and family therapist, a certified sex therapist, and holds a PhD in somatic psychology. Dr. Richmond is also one of North America's leading sex therapists, serving women, men, couples, and gender diverse individuals for relationship and sexuality issues. She counsels a broad range of clients, including Hollywood's elite. Of course, we won't ask who, and prominent corporate clientele. And Dr. Richmond works from a sex positive approach. Her book, Reclaiming Pleasure, A Sex Positive Guide for Moving Past Sexual Trauma and Living a Passionate Life, is out now and is a groundbreaking examination of both somatic and psychological factors in a survivor's recovery. We have so much to talk with you about. Dr. Holly, welcome to The Frenzy.
Thank you. Thank you again for having me.
So my first question is about a sex positive approach. What does that mean?
This is what it means to me. It means all sex is good sex as long as it's consensual and pleasurable. And the reason I love that, I'll say it one more time. All sex is good sex as long as it's consensual and pleasurable. It really gives us two boxes to check. And if it checks consent first and foremost, and if it checks pleasure, which is also incredibly important, but we don't talk about it enough, all that other chatter in our head needs to just melt away. Because so often I hear from people with kinks, fetishes, you know, well, I'm thinking about this and I'm thinking about this, or I want to do this, but I feel like that's weird, or I'm whatever the word is that they put to it. Like, is it consensual? Yep. Is it pleasurable? Okay. Then let yourself off the hook. Let's all have the kind of sex that we want to have.
Yeah. I just got finished watching on Netflix about Tab Hunter, because I love documentaries, and I'll just, you know, I knew of him and I knew he was a big name in the 50s, but it was such a fascinating story because Tab Hunter came out as homosexual later on after being this 50s, you know, icon of the perfect American male, right? Very Rock Hudson-ish, you know, they were contemporaries.
Oh, wow. And I've never heard his name before. Oh, isn't that funny?
He was probably the most popular man for a period of time in the 50s. And so in the documentary, he talks about how he got to the point where he did not like himself. He had all this success, but he knew he was gay and he knew he had to keep it a secret, and he knew he couldn't talk to friends about it because in Hollywood he would have been blacklisted had anybody found out. And so, you know, his case of course is being homosexual, but I think for a lot of people sex is tends to be a source of shame, especially for women, as opposed to something like you said that's joyful and pleasurable and something that they think about and it's 100% satisfactory all the time. So can you talk a little bit about how people use it as a weapon to hate themselves?
Yeah. First we'll talk about survivors, but I feel like there's a whole category there because something, it wasn't consensual at the time and they could have experienced arousal non-concordance, which means they didn't want it, but their body was still turned on. That gets really confusing for people and it makes them not trust their body. The other way that I feel like we kind of turn that sexual shame in on ourselves is for wanting things, again, that we don't think are normal, or not wanting things that we think everyone else wants that is normal, right? Like this, the question I get most, especially from couples, is how often should we be having sex? right? They want to know, tell me what's normal. How often should we be having sex?
Couples ask each other, at least in my experience, yeah. that has yeah. been a conversation in a true. Relationship. Yes.
Right. But I mean, I can't answer that. I can say kind of what's average, but I almost don't even care. Like, what do you want? Let's talk about how we can bring that together instead of one person, the higher libido partner feeling shame because they don't want to make their partner do something that their partner doesn't want to do, but they also have sexual needs and they're like, well, oh my gosh, am I going to have to move through the rest of my life without having my needs met? And then the lower libido partner was like, well, I want my partner to be happy, but I also don't want to betray myself to give him or her what they want.
Yes,
that's true. So what is the answer there?
A lot of talking. I don't love the word compromise, but really reimagining, re-envisioning what sex is. And really making sure it's not, you know, if we're talking about a heteronormative relationship, it doesn't have to be penetration. Like, let's get more creative than that and come up with something that works for you both. I'm just going to go out there on a limb. It might mean giving more permission around masturbation. I still see so many couples, they have no idea what the other is doing in their own personal sex life with their own personal body. They pathologize that.
And I want to follow up with that just really quickly.
Yeah.
Because women seem to have a stunted growth into that realm of their sexuality because we seem to be taught that, okay, the boy will take care of you. And then the boys are encouraged to masturbate, right? And so, you know, because there's always the joke about the socks on the floor, or the locked bathroom door. You know, I have a son. And when my son was born, there were guys that were giving me advice about his masturbation later on in life. When he was an infant, you know, guys felt comfortable talking about that with me, which is fine, but they felt comfortable talking about that period, where a lot of women don't even attempt to try that until they're older, if they do it at all. So, you know, that's also something I'm sure you see a lot where women, why don't we feel comfortable in possession and the pleasure of our own bodies?
Well, first, because we live in a patriarchy, you know, males' pleasure has been prioritized. That's where all the research has gone. I think it's getting better. Like, my hope is that it's getting better. My younger clients, like that 20 to 26, they're masturbating. But I know for my generation and, you know, a lot of us didn't discover well, we discovered it as children, but we were completely shamed about it. We didn't discover it for pleasure well into our 20s, 30s, even 40s. Mm-hmm.
And what about someone who could be listening right now, a woman in her 40s, 50s, or older, who has never gone there? You know, how do you start, right? How do you start embracing that pleasure, even if you have felt shame around it up until this point?
So sexual health is part of our overall health. Sex and self are not dualistic. Right. So when people are talking about self-care, it seems to be like time to yourself, facials, a bubble bath, exercise, eating right. I never hear anyone say, oh, and masturbation, right? Like, I've got to go masturbate. I feel like part of my job is like that has to be part of the equation. Now, when I say has to be, it's for asexual people, which are a small percentage of the population. The masturbation might not be such a calling, but the understanding what they need for themselves is. So it's not an omission, it's a choice. Like, I'm not going to choose that. But for most people, we want to feel whole, and our sexual health is part of that equation. So I would say first, do you know Betty Dodson's work? She did body positive workshops for a long time. She would get women together in a room in her New York City apartment with a mirror, and everyone would sit around and look at their vulvas.
I've seen that a parody in like Fried Green Tomatoes and different movies. Yes, yes.
So look at what you're touching. So before you even touch, I think it's really important for women to understand what their vulva looks like, where the clitoris is, their labia, a little bit of how it functions. There's this great art installation called The Great Wall of Vagina. It should be called The Great Wall of Vulva, but it's just all of these different vulvas, right? Because if women have watched porn, if they've watched, you know, we get such a sterilized view of that's what a pretty vulva looks like. And they just all look different. And there's no right way to look. There's no wrong way to look. So know what you're looking at. And then I have a protocol that I use that doesn't start with the genitals. It would just mean a person getting into bed with herself for 20 to 30 minutes and exploring self-touch anywhere on the first time but the genitals. So just sticking with hair, neck, chest, stomach, legs. And then the next session, she could add in breasts. The next session, she could add in butt and vulva and just really work her way up. So it's not just completely genitally focused.
Well, and you know, you talk about how it's something that a woman has to ease into. I was looking up as you were speaking, and when you talked about that, I was like, you know, there have been so many references to masturbation in songs by guys like there, and I couldn't remember the name and I still couldn't get it in time of a band, you know, 90s band who talked about being bored, or is it 80s band? And that, you know, and masturbation was a part of their boredom. They're like, you know what, I'm just going to go masturbate because I'm bored. And it's in a song. And again, men are openly talking about this, and the song was not controversial. Yet when Cyndi Lauper released She Bop back in the 80s, it was controversial because she was talking about a girl touching herself. So, you know, again, I have always been amazed because I have met people who well into adulthood had never masturbated. And I just found it sad, honestly, because again, this is your machine. So you need to know how it functions before you can let anybody else try to function it. Right. And so it's like a woman going into sex blind because she's relying on everybody else to take care of her.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a sexually empowered woman is dangerous in the best kind of way. In the best kind of way. So we haven't promoted that as a society. It changes things. If a woman starts having sex for pleasure, then we've got to get past all the old tropes of slut shaming and you know, all of that. We just have to rethink it. And I don't think there's parts of this country that aren't just quite ready for that yet, I think. Mm-hmm.
So if a woman is getting to know herself better, and I love the step-by-step, I think that's brilliant. Can that enhance her relationship? Like, how does that go hand in hand? I'm a woman who's been married now almost 11 years, and, you know, we're still very much in love. But after that amount of time, of course, there's like, you know, you want to be able to rediscover one another. So can self-pleasure help you reconnect with your partner?
Absolutely. Yes, yes, yes. And this, again, the self-pleasure is the first step. And then if the my client is partnered, then the partner comes into the bedroom. Because what Melissa said, like, you need to know how to drive this before you give someone else the keys. So really, you know, I like my clitoris touched this way, not this way. Some women need more pressure. Some women need less. You guys know most women don't have an orgasm from penetration. So really, when we're talking about that clitoral stimulation, it's key to know what you like. Often the upper left quadrant of the clitoris, so this tiny little bulb of the clitoris, upper left quadrant is often the most sensitive, but not for everyone. For some women, their clitoris is super sensitive. So remember, 8,000 nerve endings for the clitoris, 4,000 for the head of a penis. Like, it's just different. So every woman's going to like it to be touched in a different way.
How do you handle helping women who are older and their libido is gone on the downturn? You know, so whether it's because of menopause, whether it's, you know, a psychological, you know, thing. What about women who have given up and said, you know what, that's not a part of my life anymore?
Yeah, I have so many of those clients. I'm going to say the word again. You guys are just going to have to title this episode Masturbate. But masturbation, sex begets sex. The more sex we have, the more sex we want. And that's quite literally hormonal. So there's those good hormones that are flowing through us. If she's masturbating and reaching orgasm, that's good for her as well because of the hormones, but also pelvic floor health. So we age, that pelvic floor can experience a little bit of laxity, especially if you had children, and orgasms strengthen it. So orgasms are those little pelvic floor contractions. It's like a workout. So there's a lot of good reasons to have sex with yourself. So I would say masturbate. If she's just like, I can't get there, figure out what turns you on. Like, what's sexy to you? Is it reading erotica? Is it watching a sexy movie on Netflix? Like, what is it that does it for you? Just fantasizing. Really give yourself, I would say, half an hour at least twice a week to just fantasize and try to build up, then get yourself in bed and take it from there.
And for couples who want to reconnect and sort of reignite the flame, what's some of the things that they can do together?
God, there's a lot. So get creative. One of the exercises I love is a fantasy exchange. So write down one fantasy. Your partner would write down one fantasy in exchange and start small. So I don't know, Jen, let's say your fantasy is to get a full body massage. And that's it. And your partner's fantasy is whatever. So you would exchange that, really start trusting each other, trusting that vulnerability. And then you can up the ante sexually.
Oh, so you don't start with a medieval story of, right. You know, being in the tower and no. Okay. All right.
I don't know your partner. Maybe that'll go fine.
Honey, I'm single. So I feel bad. I feel bad for the next woman that comes along because it's been a long pandemic, my love. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely has. Yeah.
But as the good news is, as we're coming out of it, we're going into the whoring 20s. So you're all
there
set.
You go.
Yes. I like that.
I love that. That's great.
Off you go. Yeah. So just to get creative, it takes so much courage for a lot of couples to start talking about sex. I mean, we just don't get that training either. And I know this for a fact, the healthiest couples talk about sex. Sex just doesn't happen, especially 11 years in. Sure, it happens in the first year or two, but then you're out of that limerence phase and you've got to put some work into it.
Right. And we have young kids, so we usually schedule it. Yeah. So there's no spontaneity anymore. It's like, okay, Saturday afternoon at 2:00, what are you doing? Okay, don't schedule anything. You know, the in-laws are not allowed to come over and have a pop in at that time because this is going to be, you know, kids get the iPads, go. So it's not the same. You know, it's a lot more planned. You know, it's not the same kind of like spontaneous, like, I mean, we used to do it in the car when we first met, you know, I mean, it was like wild and, you know, like so fun. And now it just has to be a little bit more planned. So I'm glad you say talking about it really helps because I think a lot of couples feel like they can't bring it up with each other. It feels like this awkward situation.
But it sounds like, though, when she talked about exchanging fantasies and stuff, there's things you can do that is not a part of the activity that leads up to the activity that can be spontaneous, right?
Right.
So, and to Jen's point, now I've been in relationships in which sex was a source of fighting. Right. That it was the difference in libido, the difference in energy level, and then when the scheduling tried to happen, then there was resentment. Then there was the feeling of, you know, being obligatory. And so it was, you know, it was it became very toxic. And so, you know, how do you talk to couples who are almost using it as a weapon of like, if you love me, this is what you'll do.
Yeah. I mean, that never works, does it? I mean, Melissa, I can't imagine.
I'm single.
that doesn't work. And I want both people to get their needs met, but one's needs can't take priority over the other. So again, it would be sitting down. If two people can just do it together, great. If they need a moderator or a mediator, that's where I come in, just to reimagine what can this look like. Does one, like what I was saying before, does one person need permission to masturbate? I am not kidding you guys. Today in contemporary marriages, I still get this, I don't want my husband to masturbate because that's like, feels like it's cheating on me.
Really?
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. And if my wife wants to masturbate, why isn't she asking me for sex? I'm like, well, the two don't equal each other. They're different. Sometimes your wife is going to just want to have time to herself, but it's like just kind of getting these ideas across.
Is it the jealousy too, though? I'm thinking of, you know, because a woman is, you know, sexual, sometimes for men, they're a sexual object for the man, right? And so them being independently sexual does not make sense. On the other turn about him cheating, are people concerned about what you're thinking about while you're masturbating? Is that the cheating part that, you know, that people are concerned about?
You nailed it. And what if, and I'm being very heteronormative, but this certainly happens in same-sex relationships as well. So let's just say the female partner, the male partner is watching porn or doing something. What if he wants her more than he wants me. I don't have that body. So there's just a lot of jealousy wrapped up in there. And I swear in all my years doing this, I've never had a man leave his wife for a porn star. Like it just
right.
Really, like, so we don't get to control our partner's imagination and fantasy. When we do that, like eroticism is just gone, that life force, that desire. Like we all have to have permission to fantasize.
Well, it sounds like sex is being used as possession, and that we have this idea of sex as possession instead of an expression. And maybe that's, you know, part of the problem.
It is. It is. And can you imagine sitting down and talking about that instead of how many times a week are we having sex?
Mm-hmm. What's so true?
Yeah.
So how, as parents, do we change the pattern with raising kids? And you have children, right?
I do, Jen. I love that you schedule sex. So do I. The only the only way I know to get out of scheduling it is to take to go away for 2 days. And I know, you know, not everybody has family or a sitter situation where they can do that, but it's scheduling's the way to go.
Yeah, definitely. And what about with raising our kids? I mean, mine are still young, so we're not talking about sex yet, but you know, before we blink, they'll be teenagers and grownups. Like, how can we help them not have the same hangups that our generation did with their bodies, with sexuality? I'm raising two girls. Melissa has a son. So speak to it from either gender.
Yeah. Jen, how old are your kids?
They are 8 and 6.
Okay. I've got 6 and 8.
Okay. There we go.
two boys. So we're, oh my gosh, I know exactly where you are. And Melissa, how about you? How old's your daughter?
Well, a son, and he's 7.
Oh, my son.
Yes. 7? He's 7. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Man, we're in it. I'm so proud of us right now.
I know we are.
And
they still want to be around us. This, I adore it because in my mind, I'm thinking, my baby mama, as I call her, she said the other day, she's like, a third of his time with us is done. And I'm like,
oh, dagger.
Yeah. And I was, and so, cause we were talking about, we got, you know, and it, because we're older moms. And so we always are having these conversations about, okay, we got to slow down and live in the moment. This is our one chance, you know, cause we're one and done because we're no longer together. And so, but anyway, so I love it. Cause I'm thinking by the time he is having sex, he's not going to have anything to do with mama. So at least right now he's still, I'm still the person he wants to marry. Well, actually, no, there's another girl he wants to marry, but still I'm the backup plan. I'm the backup plan.
How sweet is that? I love it. Oh my God. I'm so happy to connect with you both. I'm a late in life mom too. And I was supposed to be one and done, and I didn't get my period after that one. And I thought I was in menopause.
And you weren't. Surprise.
We're not.
Surprise. Oh, that's awesome.
That's great.
Yeah. So here we are.
Yes. So what can we do now? Because what can we do now with our children to make them sexually empowered in 10 years?
Yeah. And I bet you guys are doing this. Do you use the correct names for their body parts?
Yes, absolutely.
Vagina is spoken in our house like 100 times a day.
Okay. Yes. Penis and scrotum. We talk about both.
Yeah. Perfect. I mean, we haven't gotten into vulva and clitoris and all that yet, but we'll get there.
Yeah, I think that would be up next. For me, oh my gosh, if the boys listen to this ever, but they're already getting erections, right?
Yes, so, yes. I was going to say, we call it when his penis is standing up is what is the language.
Yeah. And one of my sons is just like, almost doesn't even notice it. And the other, he really doesn't like it. Like he's like, it's a feeling that he doesn't love. So we just talk about it, and it's just part of your natural body. And it's just a self-check system to make sure you're healthy. I say like your sexual health is part of, you know, what keeps you healthy. So just all of this language around sexual health. But I think what we can really do is listen, don't dodge the questions. Like they're going to have questions. And if we keep engaging with them in an intimate way. So what I mean, it's intimate into me see, if our children feel seen, however they are, whatever their sexuality is going to be, whatever questions they have, they'll dare to bring those to us. And then we can answer honestly.
Well, it like, for instance, like my son the reason that scrotum came into the conversation, we were in the bath and he was wondering, what is that? And so I did the correct name, and then I explained to him how it would look different later. Right. So nothing has descended. So it's like, that's actually going to look different. Okay. And then I started saying, and there, when you get grown, and I told him what the shape would be. And I said, and some people call it balls. And he laughed, thinking that was the most hilarious thing he's ever heard. And you know,
it is pretty funny. I mean,
yeah. And so, and I talked about it, like I was telling him that I needed to clip my toenails. And Jen and I've had these conversations as our children have grown up, because Jen's actually the one to reinforce to me to make sure that I said the proper, you know, names for all of his body parts. And I want him to be a man who is comfortable walking around naked in his own home. That is my goal.
Well, and Melissa and I talked about it early on, because I went to our child's preschool had a whole parent like learning session on how to help prevent your child from being sexually abused. And that was one of the first things that came up, was to use proper pronouns, because children who have language around their genitals, talk openly with their parents about that, are less likely targets for abusers. Because the abuser would know that child has words around this and would go tell someone. So anyway, it was a very eye-opening learning session. And then I told all my friends with kids everything that I learned. And I know this kind of leads us to where your book is. Dr. Richmond, can you talk about your new book? It's called Reclaiming Pleasure, A Sex Positive Guide for Moving Past Sexual Trauma and Living a Passionate Life. I know so many women have experienced it. Yes. So speak to why did you want to write this book?
Yes. Yes. So many women, a lot, way too many men, and even a disproportionately higher amount of non-binary identified people. So I just want to put that out there.
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you said that. Yes.
Yes, of course.
I wrote this book. Why did it? There's so many reasons. So I got my master's. Okay, let me start at the beginning. So I was a journalist for 15 years. And wrote for magazines, mostly like women's fitness, beauty, architecture, and design. And I remember one day very succinctly, like getting an article assignment from my editor on lip gloss. And I swear to God, it was like the fifth lip gloss article in 14 or 15 months. And I was like, if I have to write one more article about lip gloss, gonna lose my damn mind. So I knew I was transitioning out. At that point, I read this book called True Notebooks by Mark Salzman. He was teaching creative writing at a boys' detention facility in Los Angeles. And it just, like, it hit me so hard, like the profound changes in those boys, the profound change in Mark himself. So I just got a bug up my butt and was like, I'm going to go do that, and called girls' detention facilities around the Los Angeles area where I lived at the time and said, hey, I want to come teach creative writing. And they were like, for free? And I was like, yep, for free. So I did that once a week for about 2 years, and just had some beautiful experiences, but heard story after story of girls who experienced sexual abuse, sexual trauma, gang rape. And they would write about it just like they would write about going to the store, going to school. Like it would just, you know, it would just come out. And there wasn't a lot of emotion attached to it, not because there wasn't emotion there, but they just, it was so normalized. It was so normalized. And all I could say at the time was, you know, that's not okay. And I was like, damn, that's not really good enough. So I went back to graduate school, did my 3,000 hours at a rape crisis center, wrote my dissertation on the recovery of sexual health after sexual assault. And then that's where this book comes in. I like really just expanded it to sexual trauma. So it's sexual abuse, sexual assault, rape, sexual harassment, sexual violence. So really looking at all the categories many years later.
First of all, thank you for doing that. Secondly, as I've grown older, I find that I will turn off a show or a movie if I find out that the entertainment of value of this show is to solve a rape or to solve a murder of a woman after she has been raped, because she's never murdered. She's always raped before she's murdered. And so when you talk about normalization for these particular women, it seems our culture, even though we try to be progressive and evolved, there is still a this I don't know, tendency for most, especially crime dramas, everything to be about the woman got raped and killed, and now we're feeling protective of her, so we need to solve the crime. And I can't stomach it anymore, because it's not entertainment to me.
Yeah, it's horrible. And you guys saw the news. Hopefully, it's okay to say this with timing. Sarah Everhard in London. I mean, it just keeps coming up. We need to change the system.
And it's not even indigenous women and, you know, different, you know, women of different races are not even reported or given that much attention in the media, as well. So it's everywhere. But do you think that media can, I mean, I'm sounding like my mother now or my grandmother, but I, as a media personality, I'm concerned by the entertainment value that people are ingesting that is normalizing rape.
Right. Yeah. Melissa, I don't feel like I can say it any better than that. We have to change the system. Jen, I have some hope that you as a parent went to the sexual abuse training. Like, we have to know what we're talking about. It's always existed. It still exists. But the more awareness we have about it, I think that's the only way to prevent it. And for our children to be able to say no, to scream, to make a fuss. I mean, I don't know how you guys were raised, but I was taught to be a good girl and just kind of go along to get along and be nice. I don't want my kids to do that. I want you to scream your head off if something doesn't feel right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's also important for us women who were raising men. This is not just an issue for girls to learn how to keep from getting raped. To me, it's more important for us to teach our boys, don't rape. You're the problem. Stop rape. Right. I mean, women have raped too. I've known lesbians that have been raped by women, but the majority is men doing this. And we have to teach men to stop raping. That would help a lot. Right.
Yeah. It's just, it's, I shake my head because I'm like, it's just kind of phenomenal that we have to teach people not to rape people. Like, just don't rape people.
Just don't rape.
Right. Holly, I saw on your Instagram something that you posted I thought was really interesting. You said if it felt abusive, it was abusive. That really resonated with me, because I think that we learned so much with Me Too, right? I mean, with the Me Too movement, it was like all of a sudden, everybody felt okay saying it out loud. And everybody was able to come forward and together try to heal from whatever has happened. But I think sometimes if it wasn't, like what you guys are saying, if it wasn't a full-blown rape, does it count? Am I allowed to have feelings around it? And I think that what your quote, if it felt abusive, it was abusive, to me was like, oh, wow, that's really inclusive and empowering for people to hear.
Yes, because we have this idea in our head, perpetuated by media, that sexual trauma has to be violent. Mm-hmm. Most sexual trauma isn't violent. Over 85% is perpetuated by someone known to the survivor. It's not violent, and especially sexual abuse. Most of the time, that looks like extra care, extra attention, presence, a little trip. Oh, this is our special time. Let's keep this secret. Like, it's not violent. It's non-consensual. That's the only barometer to measure sexual trauma. Was it consensual? And in this case, it wasn't. So if a woman is, slapped on the ass at work for 5 years, like that, if it felt abusive, it was abusive. I want her to let herself off the hook, because she's been trying for 5 years to be like, oh, that wasn't a big deal. It didn't mean anything. But somewhere in her body, she's screaming, right? Mm-hmm. Somewhere she's either in chronic pain, she's got anxiety, she's got depression, she's got an eating disorder. Who knows? Because her body's like, yeah, I really didn't like that. My boss feels horribly abusive, but everyone's telling me it's not a big deal. So what's my problem? I'm crazy. Right. Yeah. Just can't do that anymore.
Well, of course. And then is, our language for women, of course, why were you wearing? Where were you? Why weren't you with a friend? You know, it's always questions of the girls, what they did wrong. But I want to also go back to Jen's point about, helping empower, being inclusive, is also what you said earlier about how there really is a difference between body and mind. You know, they're connected, but they are separate. And when you talk about someone who's being abused, but yet their body responds to it in a just a mechanical body without thinking response, that causes women to feel even more guilt, because they think they're contributing to it and being consensual by what their bodies are doing. Correct?
Absolutely. So again, that word arousal non-concordance, but it basically means our mind goes without our body, or our body goes without our mind. And Melissa, what you just said, so the body goes without our mind. For women, for people with vaginas, we lubricate as a form of self-protection. Because can you imagine if someone with a penis or an object tried to penetrate us and there was no lubrication, we would get hurt. We would tear, the injuries would be more. So in some ways that lubrication, which we just like beat ourselves up over, like this was a non-consensual experience, but my body lubricated. How do I reconcile that? The body isn't our enemy. Almost all the time it's trying to save us. We just misinterpret its cues.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That is so fascinating. So in the book, what are some, not to give it all away, because we want everybody to go yes. buy your book and read it and learn from it. But what are some things like where people can start to heal?
Mm-hmm. So there's really three parameters, and I don't mind giving these away at all because I can't do them justice in the time we have. So really the book walks through. So every chapter has a story, which is a case study, but it's a story from a real life amalgamation of a client or clients that I've seen. And then usually every chapter has at least two exercises. So two body-based somatic exercises. So it's much more holistic than how I can talk about it. But in my dissertation way back when, the parameters that I discovered for the recovery of sexual health after sexual trauma were first control. So I know this probably sounds self-evident, but there's two pieces of it here. So first, maintaining control. Obviously, you have to feel like you're in control of your body, the environment, who your partner is when you're having sex. But the other almost more important piece is the relinquishing control. So many survivors are wound tight. They're constricted, they're rigid because they were disrespected and their wishes weren't respected. So they're very tightly wound. So trying to relinquish control is just as important. And we need to relinquish control to get to the second element, which is pleasure. So many of us race through our day and we're not taking in time to experience pleasure. This can be pleasure from reading a book, eating foods we love, sitting down and relaxing, but also, of course, sexual pleasure. So really understanding our sexual template, what turns us on, what do we find sexy, exploring fantasies. And then from that point is where I segue into the third parameter, which is connection. So first, connection with yourself, and then connection with others. I wish I could say healing was a solitary experience, but it's not. Like, it always has to involve another person, community, family. I'm not saying you have to have a romantic partner, but you can't do this just solitarily, like in confinement on your own, which, gosh, with all of the survivors I've seen, like they a lot want to do that. Well, I just want to take care of myself. I want to do this on my own, but we need that piece of connection to explore that vulnerability.
Well, it's getting back in the cockpit. I mean, lack of a better term, but you know, it's you have to put yourself back into that same situation that may have been bad for you in the past in order to redefine it for yourself and be free of, you know, the binds of the trauma, you know, before that. So,
and with someone trustworthy enough to, you know, making sure that you're choosing the right person, whether that's just opening up and sharing or whether that is an intimate person, someone you can trust enough to do that. But that's a beautiful path to healing. That's amazing. Thank you so much for all this work that you've done. And for our audience, we want you to go check out drhollyrichmond.com and see her book there. It's called Reclaiming Pleasure, A Sex Positive Guide for Moving Past Sexual Trauma and Living a Passionate Life. You can also follow Dr. Holly Richmond on Instagram. And Dr. Holly, before you go, something we do with each one of our guests is called the Frenzy Five.
Yes. And your answers don't have to be sexual, but they can be. Okay. You have the freedom. You're free to do as you wish. All right. So here we go. Number one, what is your cozy, happy place?
My bed. Yeah, it's my bed and it's not sexual. I'm like one of those people that like a nest. I cannot get enough blankets and pillows. I love shit on my bed. Like, not in like a messy way, but I just like a lot of stuff.
You know, we may have to add a question to the Frenzy Five, and here's a follow-up. How many pillows do you have on your bed?
Oh, gosh. Right now, I think only five.
Only five.
Is that too many?
No, there's no wrong answers.
I have 10.
Whoa.
I'm with you. I like a lot of pillows.
Look, if I have four cats, I'm the crazy cat lady. Can I, is there another, I'm sorry. No, there's no judgment. There's no judgment. All right. Number two of our frenzy five. What's your favorite framed thing in your home?
Oh my gosh. You know what? It's my wedding picture, because I was older when I got married, and in that picture, we didn't know yet, but I was pregnant, and you can just it's like the side angle of me. And when I look at it, I see my belly and my first son, which was really, so I was 43 then. And it's just, it feels like a little miracle, and just like the beginning. And then, you know, a year and a half later, the second. Aww. So it just feels like, when I look at that picture, not in the cheesy, oh, my wedding day, like it's not that. It's just really the beginning of something I never even saw coming.
Oh, I love it.
Beautiful. Yeah.
All right. What is your most memorable birthday?
Ooh. Probably my 40th, because I had just finished my master's in clinical psychology. Like it was at that same time. So again, going back to school, I changed a lot in my life. I changed careers. I changed partners. There was just a lot happening, and it all happened around 40.
Oh, that's a great shift that you made
in your life. Yeah. Good for you.
All right. Number four of our frenzy five. What's a daily routine or ritual that you stick to?
I'm going to say the thing like the digital.
And if you say masturbation, I will be impressed. I'm just kidding.
Damn it. No, I wish. That's goals. Absolutely goals. I eat cookies for breakfast. Like I just do. Like I just like
cookies. Girl.
Fantastic answer. Oh, nobody has said that. I promise you that.
Oh my gosh. You know how many people just changed their hero to you? And the final question of our frenzy five is, what fashion trend did you jump on? And it could be any era.
Oh, I mean, it definitely. So I was a teenager in the 80s. You should have seen the size of my hair.
Yes.
Like the
bangs
and the feathers, like the curling iron where you kind of like leave the roll in it.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I'm an 80s teen as well. Yeah. Yes.
How many times feathered?
Yeah. Feathered, but yeah.
How many people thought were hickeys, but it was actually burn marks from the curling iron did you have? That was a constant thing in the 80s. I'm sorry. There should be no follow-ups, but thank you for answering the frenzy five.
Such good questions, and I feel like I could have answered them better if you had sent them to me, but it's so much better to be spontaneous.
You did a fantastic job. Dr. Holly Richman, thank you so much for joining us. Y'all go follow her at Dr. Holly Richman on Instagram, and we hope you'll join us again.
Oh, thank you.
Is there a friend of yours who would enjoy this episode? Please share this with her. And on Apple Podcasts, here's what you do. You click on the three dots at the top right corner, and then in the drop-down menu, select share episode, and then you can share it however you want. The green messages option will let you text it right to a friend.
We would love for you to also sign up for our weekly email, where we send the episode right to your inbox. We make it very easy for you. We also include links on things we discuss and give you some deeper insights to the topics that we cover. And it's how you can also get into our private Facebook group by signing up at the frenzy.com today.
And if you are enjoying the Frenzy podcast with Melissa Carter and me, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you are listening to podcasts and leave us a review. That helps us more than you can imagine. And we really want to reach more people just like you.
And here is your reminder, this is the most important thing we do, right? Is to help you share your story. That's the point of all of this. Open up about your story with trusted friends. Your story absolutely matters.
Please follow The Frenzy on Instagram. That's at The Frenzy with a ZY at the end of friend. If you want to share about the show, tag us so that we can repost it and thank you.
We are everywhere, okay? We're accessible to you everywhere because we also are on YouTube. We have a Frenzy YouTube channel. We finally have a vanity URL, the Frenzy Podcast. So please go to our YouTube channel and you can see some extended interviews, see some bloopers, see what we look like. If you don't know what we look like, again, the YouTube, the Frenzy Podcast.
So exciting. The Frenzy is hosted and produced by Melissa Carter and me, Jen Hobby.
Sound editing by Bo Johnson. Original soundtrack produced by Tammy Hurt for Placement Music. Written and recorded by Mark Dannels.
The Frenzy celebrates friendships over 40. Thank you so much for spending your time with us. We love your friendship.
All right, until next week, trust your gut,
share your story,
and stop lying about your age.
Age.
We'll see you on Monday.